KALW.
The monarchs stuck around for like 4 or 5 days, and then one day they just disappeared.
People have been bugging out about a possible monarch butterfly extinction.
Maybe everything had just a terrible year statewide. We wouldn't know because nobody's been looking.
We'll consider what a focus on the butterfly means for other creatures affected by climate change. Then we'll meet a young man who's helping his Mayan community speak their truth in Bay Area courts.
Some people are waiting years to get a case to be settled, and the only reason why they wait so long is because there's no one to interpret.
And we'll hear a delicious audiograph. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today we're bringing you a special show featuring recent award-winning stories from our news department. First up, we're bringing you one about a certain creature you may have been hearing a lot about. This time of year, migrating monarch butterflies start arriving in the Bay Area to spend the winter. But last winter, scientists found the population of monarchs in the Bay Area and across California had plummeted. Some scientists were even predicting that the monarchs could go extinct in the next few years. The news made the New York Times, the New Yorker, and it was shared all over social media. But as KALW's science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch found out in this story from last year, if we just focus on monarchs and not all the insects around us, we're missing the big picture.
I have this tradition of going to see the monarchs that spend the winter at Ardenwood Farm in Fremont. If you've never been, it's incredible.
It's like standing in a snow globe full of butterflies.
East Bay Park naturalist Christina Garcia is describing what it's like on a typical year. Hundreds, sometimes thousands of butterflies fly around you.
And you can actually hear their wings fluttering if it's quiet.
This year, like every year, Garcia started to look for the monarchs around October. She says their arrival is a nice sign that fall is coming.
So I'm always excited. So I'm coming out and looking, and it was pretty much a normal year.
About 150 showed up at first.
I kept expecting more to come. And then, as you'll probably remember, in late November, we had the horrible fires.
The campfire in Butte County.
The monarchs stuck around for like 4 or 5 days, and then one day they just disappeared.
And they didn't come back. Then, during the annual Thanksgiving monarch count,
we came out 3 or 4 times a week, just hoping to see them and find the cluster, and it just wasn't here.
Monarchs are found all over the U.S. On the East Coast, the monarchs actually had a good year. It's the number of West Coast monarchs that dropped this winter. Insect populations tend to fluctuate. You have to look at many years of data to see the trends. And for both Western and Eastern monarchs, it's been a downward trend since the 80s. What's making the news now is just how low the Western monarch numbers got this winter.
This is the first year that it's gone under 30,000 for California at the Thanksgiving count. And whether they'll be able to rebound again is questionable.
Nobody knows exactly what caused the numbers to plummet this year, but you can probably guess what's causing that downward trend overall. The usual suspects: habitat loss, pesticide use, climate change, stuff that's going to affect other insects, not just the monarchs.
People have been counting the monarchs, and they haven't been counting other stuff as much.
This is Eric Simmons. He's an editor for Bay Nature, a local environmental science magazine. He says the monarchs are one of the few insects to have this statewide annual count. But what about other insects?
Maybe everything had just a terrible year statewide. We wouldn't know because nobody's been looking.
Globally, we're seeing headlines about the insect apocalypse. The truth is, it's a lot more complicated. Those headlines draw on a study here, a study there, which tend to look at one species at a time. Charismatic species like monarchs, or insects that have an economic impact like honeybees, you can't extrapolate about all insects from those specific studies, but the data they present paint a scary picture. And Simmons says the media likes to focus on that.
Like, we live in an age in which everything is going to be in crisis all the time. This is what climate change is doing to the world. And then when everything's always in crisis, it's just hopeless.
Simmons says you can find all kinds of butterflies in the Bay Area, some that are really common, some that are on the decline, and some that are rebounding after almost going extinct. And that's just one part of the insect world.
Like, hey, let's look at beetles. Like, there's so much to see and explore and pay attention to out there. And it just feels like it's so much more valuable and enriching personally to have that sort of sense of the whole than it is to just be jerked from crisis to crisis.
So, Simmons wants you to get out and see stuff, not just the charismatic stuff.
Nobody has made up a California tradition out of a pilgrimage to Twin Peaks to see the Mission Blue.
Well, there actually is this one guy.
So, here we are on a lovely morning, Twin Peaks in San Francisco.
I'm on a butterfly hunt with Liam O'Brien, a local lepidopterist and artist. Twin Peaks is the last remaining habitat in San Francisco for an endangered butterfly called the Mission Blue. If you make a pilgrimage up here in April around Earth Day, you can see them flying around.
You can't miss it. It's an electric blue little creature darting between all of these lupins.
We walk around to see what else we can find.
Hilltops become sort of the singles bar for butterflies.
O'Brien is a charismatic species himself. His niche is former Broadway actor turned fierce champion for butterflies, but not the monarchs. He feels like they have enough attention. O'Brien says people feel so emotional about these butterflies.
There's a lot of zealotry involved in wanting to help the monarch.
And sometimes they end up doing things that aren't actually that helpful, like planting milkweed, which monarch caterpillars depend on for food. But a lot of local gardeners plant tropical milkweed, a non-native species that has leaves year-round. The leaves trigger the adult butterflies to lay eggs in the winter during the wrong season.
What is next? We're going to see one of those hideous Sarah McLachlan commercials of imagine a world without the monarch. In the eyes of the monarch, you too can help save the monarch by sending us a check for $300.
O'Brien says environmental groups are kind of capitalizing on the monarch crisis right now, using it as a way to get people to donate. The best of these organizations use that money to restore habitats, fight climate change, and reduce pesticide use, efforts that could help many species. O'Brien says it's great if you want to donate to those organizations, but no nonprofit can really work to just save monarchs.
It's a charismatic creature that brings in a lot of money. It seems to be plummeting over the side of a cliff.
Without really big picture changes, it might be too late for some species.
These creatures, these mega charismatic things like polar bears, like panda bears, like monarchs, you know, you can't recreate an iceberg.
And if money isn't going to solve the problem, what can people do?
People need to just kind of calm down and let the experts figure something out.
It's going to take scientists a few more years of gathering data to see if the monarchs will continue their downward spiral or if they'll rebound. O'Brien wants people to slow down a bit and learn more before they jump into helping. He likes to paraphrase the famous biologist Jane Goodall. Only if we understand can we care. Only if we care can we help. Only if we help can they be saved.
But the problem with that quote is everyone skips the first sentence. Nobody really wants to work hard to understand.
Maybe the first part of understanding is just getting out and getting to know all the wildlife around us, not just the monarchs. From Twin Peaks, I'm Marissa Ortega Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa is KALW's science reporter. She just received the Emerging Journalist of the Year Award from the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California. That story originally aired last winter. Find out where you could see monarchs in the Bay Area this winter at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. More than 6 million people in the world speak Mayan languages. There are more than 30 Mayan languages, actually, and they're spoken across Guatemala, Mexico, Belize, Honduras, and here in the U.S. Today, East Oakland is home to several thousand speakers of MAM. That's a Mayan language indigenous to Guatemala. For migrants who don't speak Spanish, there's a language barrier when trying to access social services. So many rely on interpreters to communicate with teachers, doctors, and lawyers. Last year, reporter Marisol Medina Cadena brought us the story of one Mayan language interpreter who's part of a new generation of homegrown Oaklanders working to give their communities a voice in their native tongue.
My name is Oswaldo Martin. Yo vivo aquí en el área de Fruitvale de Oakland, ingeniería.
Oswaldo is constantly switching between English, Spanish, and his first language, Mam. When in school, he speaks English. In the neighborhood, Spanish. And in his home, Mam.
Let me check on here. So this is my grandma.
Nice to meet you.
Over the years, she's had to rely on Oswaldo to interpret for some of her doctor visits and translate mail that's sent to her in Spanish. But Oswaldo doesn't just translate for his family. For the last 3 years, he's been working as an interpreter, helping attorneys communicate with MAM speakers.
Before I got into doing it, I didn't really think too much about it. I just thought, you know, they're going to talk to the lawyer, they're going to sign some paperwork.
At the age of 4, Oswaldo and his mother left his hometown in Todos Santos, Guatemala, and settled in East Oakland. Eventually, his family was granted asylum status. And since he spent most of his life here, he didn't know the harsh realities that his community faced back home. Nor did he know the details of Guatemala's brutal 36-year civil war, since many survivors don't talk about it. But that changed when he got hired to help attorneys work with asylum seekers.
And listening to their stories, I started to realize all of the things that were happening to our community, from gang violence, domestic violence, discrimination.
What started off as just a job to pay his way through community college became much more personal for Oswaldo. He wants to help MAM speakers tell their story in their own language so that they have a fair chance at winning their cases.
We wanted to be known and to also be treated on the same level as any other language would. It's not a dialect, it's its own language, and it's completely separate from Spanish.
Before local courts understood the distinction between Mayan languages and Spanish, they would sometimes assign Spanish language interpreters for MAM speakers, which of course was useless. But awareness has grown. In 2016, the Department of Justice reported that MAM was one of the top 10 languages used in immigration court. Over the past 3 years, the Alameda County Superior Court, which deals with civil, criminal, and traffic law, has also been getting increasingly frequent requests for MAM interpreters. Finding people with those skills hasn't been so easy, though.
Some people are waiting years to get a case to be settled, and the only reason why they wait so long is because there's no one to interpret.
But Oswaldo and other English-speaking MAM millennials who migrated to the U.S. as children now have come of age. They're bridging this language gap. At the office of a local nonprofit called Asociación Mayab, bilingual Mayan speakers are gathered to learn how to be court interpreters. Although Oswaldo is already trained to work in the courts, he attends the weekly class to practice his skills and meet other interpreters. And not all speak MAM. They speak other Mayan languages, like Quiché, Setal, and Yucateco. The class is taught in Spanish so that everyone can learn.
Okay, entonces dice que el intérprete tiene que ser imparcial y objetivo y no puede tener prejuicios.
That's Naomi Adelson. She's been leading this course for the last 10 years. All her students are migrants, just like their clients. Besides teaching them how to ethically and responsibly interpret in the court, she gives them a crash course on legal terminology, like breaking down what arraignment means.
Reading charges to them in the movie.
Reading accusations. Reading instructions. That's the idea that we came up with.
Okay, no. Because what you're reading there is the charges.
The charges.
I'm telling you, what am I accusing you of?
It takes years to master interpreting skills. So many of Naomi's students keep returning to her class even after completing the training.
Remain seated. Come to order. Apartment 16 is now in session. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Benjamin Reyes. I'm one of the judges of the Superior Court. I'll be calling your cases in order.
On a Tuesday afternoon, Oswaldo was working a job for the Superior Court of Richmond. When he showed up, Oswaldo had no idea what kind of hearing this would be or who he's interpreting for. That's usually the case. And it means he has to be prepared for everything. Today, he is interpreting for a man charged with murder.
So we're here on further arraignment?
Since his client is in custody for murder charges, he can only communicate through the small openings in the wall between the courtroom and its holding cell. Think the space between prison bars, but smaller. This makes it very hard for both of them to hear each other. And the job requires major multitasking. Oswaldo has to listen to what the judges say in English, remember it, and relay it back in Mum, all in real time.
Do you understand and waive your 10-day right, sir?
Yes.
Ms. Eisenhardt, do you concur?
I didn't hear the interpreter. What was the answer, Mr. Interpreter?
He said C.
I'm sorry?
C. Yes.
Thank you.
The trial ends, and Oswaldo looks tired. But his work isn't done. Outside the courthouse, he finds the other Mum interpreter on the trial to ask how she said the phrase, waive your rights, in Mum. He's doing research for a manual he's creating in order to standardize the language Mum interpreters are using in the courts. He's taking on this ambitious project to empower other bilingual Mum speakers to become interpreters and inform government agencies how to better serve Mum refugees.
Part of it, too, is being recognized that there's a community here that's separate from the bigger Latino, Latin American culture.
Just 22 years old, he's doing all this while pursuing a civil engineering degree, helping his family's construction business, and working on his own music projects. Oswaldo says all these endeavors are about uplifting his community right here in Oakland.
There's so many Mom people here. You see them walking all down Fruitvale. You know, you can't take a step without seeing one.
He tells me that back in Guatemala, people call different neighborhoods aldeas. So Oswaldo affectionately calls his adoptive home in Fruitvale
Aldea Fruitvale,
a tight-knit community where Maya migrants are each other's greatest advocates. In Aldea Fruitvale, I'm Marisol Medina Cadena, Cross Currents.
That story originally aired last year. It won an award earlier this month for Best Feature from the San Francisco Press Club. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. The last award winner we're showcasing today is from our Audiograph series, Signature Sounds from Around the Bay. This one is about people coming together around a table.
I wanted to show them something, like another dish within the Vietnamese cuisine that they might not have tried.
When you migrate to a new country, everything seems strange at the beginning. And at that time, we didn't have a lot of Asian food.
Grilled sausage spring rolls, steaming soups, and sugarcane drinks. The Grand Century Mall food court in San Jose has the foods and the feeling of a home preserved in a collective memory. The mall is a cultural and commercial center for San Jose's over 140,000 Vietnamese. In this story that originally aired last year, Christine Nguyen explains why people drive for hours through Bay Area traffic to eat, drink, and just to hang out.
I've moved 16 times, so when I settled in San Jose, I thought, finally, now I can get some real Vietnamese food. But where to go? A friend brought me to the Grand Century Mall food court in East San Jose.
Oh, I'm a vegetarian lover of five.
We caught up over Beng Sao. It had been years since I'd torn through this sizzling crepe of coconut cream and rice flour batter. Shrimp, slivers of pork, mint, and bean sprouts spilled out the lacy edges of a golden crisp semicircle. It tasted like home.
when you migrate to a new country, everything seems strange at the beginning. And at that time, we didn't have a lot of Asian food or shopping mall.
Emily Nguyen is eating with a friend at one of the laminate tables. She's in her 40s and came to San Jose as a teenager.
That's one of the main reasons why they built this mall, so for us to continue that tradition and pass it down to our children so then the younger generation can learn about the culture.
Emily easily navigates between her native and adopted cultures. But Hung just immigrated a year ago. She says eating at the Grand Century Mall makes her feel less lost. She says she's homesick. At the mall, she sees lots of other Vietnamese. They're familiar to her. And she can find dishes from her hometown here.
I want a small one. Yeah, yeah.
A group of Buddhist nuns with shaved heads and brown robes check out the merchandise at a cell phone and phone accessory shop. Then, with beatific smiles, they walk across the mall's pink terrazzo tiles to order sugarcane drinks. Shoppers stop for a meal after buying some snacks, dragon fruit or giant pomelos for an ancestor altar. Each restaurant is a pretty bare-bones operation with the owner on side and a few employees. Like traditional Vietnamese street food, each vendor specializes in one or a few dishes. That's how you know they'll be good at what they make.
I'm going to opt for all the food. Because I love food.
Gui is here with his wife. They're from Pittsburgh, California, and make the trip to San Jose every few weeks to get a hit of someone else's home cooking.
Tôi đang ăn cái món miếng vịt. Yeah.
So miếng vịt is like a skinny glass noodle with duck, right?
Good.
He likes that he can eat glass noodles with roast duck one day, ginger chicken the next, and if he feels like it, a bowl of porridge. He says it's convenient because after a long drive, he doesn't have to move his car again. But there's probably more to it. I think he and his wife find comfort being around familiar people, food, and sounds.
No.
Here, the spicy, complicated dishes of Central Vietnam, the clear flavors of the North, and the sweet, savory intensity of the South comfortably rub shoulders. You know, it's not just locals that come to the food court. People from all over the Bay Area and beyond go out of their way to come here. Even Vietnamese who spent most of their lives in the U.S. want to be part of a community bonded by a love of food and communal eating. Philip says the Grand Century Mall reminds him of childhood memories and trips to Vietnam.
I remember visiting Vietnam, and you could get sugarcane drinks like on the side of the streets, and they would just give it to you in like a Ziploc bag with a straw, and then they put a little kumquat in it. So it makes me think of that.
Outside the food court, beside a fountain and the mall's peach-colored McMansion-esque entry, groups of men cluster around cafe tables with the odd glass of beer and packs of cigarettes.
This table, all of them are my friends. That's why I take the seat right here to talk. Maybe from 10 until 2 p.m. until 3 p.m.
Every day, Mr. Nhạc Trần sits here in the shadow of a statue of Trần Hưng Đạo, a 13th century military hero who defended Vietnam from three Mongol invasions.
I have been here on more 25 years.
Was it very exciting when they opened this mall?
You look outside, a lot of people come here to enjoy, to kill time, and meet the people to talk.
One man wears a maroon Army Ranger beret, another an FBI hat. Another man is younger, maybe in his 50s. He's muscular and in fatigues, and they all look like regulars. But no one wanted to talk to me except for Mr. Chen.
Take the tea, take the coffee, they sit and talk together.
I ask him if he's here to play cards with friends. No games, he insists. They just sit and talk. There's a lot to discuss.
We have a lot of things to talk about the past, about the future of the children, a lot of things.
For Mr. Chen and his fellow veterans, the Grand Century Mall is not about the food. For them, the mall means that the Vietnamese people are here to stay, that even if they lost the war, they positively shaped the nation, even an expatriate nation. Like most expats, these men remember the fall of Saigon as the day we lost our homeland. For a long time, they dreamed of taking it back. And over the years, those dreams have changed from taking Vietnam back to going back one last time. But for now, they sit here at the Grand Century Mall, nursing a drink or a snack and soaking up a little bit of home. For Cross Currents, I'm Christine Nguyen in San Jose.
Thanks, Christine. That story originally aired last year, and it won a Light Features Award this month from the San Francisco Press Club. You can find all of our stories when they originally air by subscribing to our Cross Currents newsletter. Find a link at kalw.org, click Cross Currents. We're off tomorrow for Thanksgiving, so tune in on Monday for the next episode of Uncuffed. We'll hear from men inside San Quentin State Prison as they consider masculinity and music.
I remember that first time, I'll never forget the way I felt when I wrote that poem. You know what I mean? I felt like there was release. Like I felt like there was some weight off my shoulders and I cried. Like I really cried after I wrote that poem.
A new episode of Uncuffed. It drops Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. All right, time for us to tune into some local soulful sounds. This is Sean Hayes from San Francisco. He's playing at the Chapel in his hometown this Friday night. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.
Miss her when I'm gone. Miss her when I'm gone. Got to make my money. Got to make my money. Miss her when I'm gone.